In these days when nearly everyone is looking for some type of spiritual guidance, the religious situation seems to suggest a certain amount of thoughtfulness. As you realize, religion is finally a very personal matter. And while religions as groups have vast followings, each member of such groups is an individual. And it is impossible to assume that the individual working from within himself and from his own patterns of experience is going to interpret a faith in exactly the same way as his neighbor. Actually, our religious need originates in our own personal integration. We are all subject to specializations of attitudes. We are subject to the modifications of race and nation and environment. Very many individuals are highly influenced by childhood religious allegiances, family faiths, racial faiths. All these have their part in creating the new religious pattern that we must each have for ourselves. To therefore sit down with a member of your own church does not mean that you will see eye to eye. Each member has his own experience patterns, which have to be considered and accepted. Some individuals, as we know, have specific talents, abilities in business, art, music, literature, philosophy, science. These aptitudes, through training, affect the point of view of religion. The individual's religion may be strongly influenced by his profession. It may be influenced through marriage. In many different ways, the individual's internal spiritual resources present themselves in patterns which the average person does not understand. We know, for example, that those belonging to certain political groups have more or less renounced religion. But this does not mean that the person in the body has renounced religion. It does not mean that the consciousness in us turns from spiritual consolation. As Behme, the great German mystic, pointed out, the life is entirely guided from the consciousness of the divine in the human heart. Now, many persons do not know that they even possess this dimension of consciousness. They do not realize that within themselves is the leadership of a power greater than their own. Actually, the person does not make up his mind about what he is going to believe. His beliefs are based upon need, upon inner insight, and upon the pressures of circumstances. All of these condition the person in his believing. Now, we know there are many religions in the world, and that they, each of them, has a different perspective on certain matters. But in general, all religious teaching is approximately the same. All religions have the same moral codes, the same ethical convictions, and demand the same integrities from their followers. These come from within the religion and from within the follower. On the other hand, the expression of religious conviction in daily life is conditioned by allegiances of one kind or another. And one of the most difficult of these allegiances to cope with is sectarianism. Sectarianism creates a sense of moral duty to protect the sect and the spiritual obligation to follow whatever beliefs that sect happens to teach. Therefore, religious devotion, in these terms, is obedience to a system of belief. Now, to believe this and to follow this as a natural conviction is sometimes to come into serious conflict with the spirituality that abides in the normal human heart. Many people I have discussed religion with have admitted that they were doing things in the name of their particular belief which were not harmonious to their own inner convictions. And one of the most common of these is the tendency to downgrade or depreciate the beliefs of other people. Loyalty becomes a defense of sect rather than the defense of truth. It, of course, is always assumed that the sect is the custodian of the truth. But as we observe the conflicts between these different systems, we realize that they cannot all be correct, nor can any one of them necessarily be correct completely. It follows, then, that we have a considerable, movable religious population. Millions of people drift or flow from one belief to another in the search of that which is peculiarly suitable to their own needs. What they are really doing is trying to find their own belief in an institution outside of themselves. Now, many people feel that under these conditions, it is necessary to change beliefs, that they must retire from that which no longer satisfies and align themselves with something that is nearer to their own conviction. Actually, if we study the matter carefully, we realize that this motion is not necessarily justified. Most religions have themselves levels within themselves. And nearly every religion in the world contains elements of all the others. It means, for example, that a very orthodox denomination may have within itself several grades of orthodoxy, the highest of which may be a pure mysticism, which would meet the need of many very conscientious and dedicated individuals. There is nothing in any religion of importance that prevents a person from being correct, being right, being fulfilled within himself. But he may have to move upward from a literalism to a mysticism. But he may find it within the very sect he belongs to. And there is no major religion of the world that does not subdivide and have within it mystical, metaphysical, and esoteric structures. They're all there. They all have followers. They represent levels in which the individual ascends when he is no longer able to accept literalism without question. So it may well be that each person can grow, unfold, and ascend through interpretation, through the structure of his own belief, whatever it may be. He does not necessarily have to change. All he has to do is to grow upward within the structure. Now, he may find, under certain conditions, that this growing up within the structure brings with it creedal inharmonies. He may be criticized by those who have a more literal point of view. He may not yet be considered suitable for those who have highly mystical and abstract convictions. But he still, if he wishes to, can grow quietly and gradually to the level of consciousness natural to himself. His religion must be natural to his inner life. It must not cramp him. It must not pervert his various attitudes. It must not bring with it selfishness or self-centeredness or vainglory. He must gradually unfold in the terms of his own experience that which he desires to believe. And if he does this from within himself, he is a follower of the heart doctrine. And the heart doctrine is present in every religion of the world. This stratification of religion results in a series of sectarian divisions within faiths. In the case of Christianity, we have an incredible number of separate organizations and organisms, all held together by the common thread of Christianity. These different groups have varied beliefs. They do not have recognition of mutual integrities. They are not sure which is the best or the better, but they do have the right to worship God according to the conviction of conscience. We all have that right, and it is not necessary in most instances to leave the faith that we belong to in order to exercise this right. It is natural to us, and we find within religions and groups that appear to be rather primitive, some very highly developed moral instincts, high ethical standards, and deep reverence for divine matters. So we have all these different divisions to consider. We also realize that there are new faiths coming into the world almost every day. There are also old ones gradually dying out. Religion, to have vital and contemporary significance, has to be applicable to the problem of the living generation. It has to serve the needs of those of us who are here now, who must face the problems of our time, and who must develop within themselves resources against the pressures of unkindly providence. This recognition of the contemporary need has resulted in a large group of new interpretations. Some of these interpretations are supported by documentations of one kind or another, some by research projects, some by contemplations and detachments, some by the minglings of Eastern and Western beliefs, and still others, and perhaps the largest group of all, is the group that is dedicated to the personal experience of an adequate faith. The individual struggling for what he needs will find it unless the pressures of other circumstances prevent him from exploring his own spiritual resources. We must assume, as the ancients did, that we are alive because life is within us. We are beings because being is within us. And we worship because God is within us. The deity that is indwelling becomes the final guardian of our conduct and our destiny. It is true also that this being in us is expressing itself through various levels of release. This being is locked within the integration of our own personal attitudes at any given time. This inner light can shine through only to the degree that we give it the opportunity to shine through. If we block the quiet voice of spirit by intellectual activities and conflicts, if we attempt to rationalize intellectually that which can be known only mystically, we come into serious confusions. Also, if we approach religion historically, we may be in confusion and uncertainty. The histories of religion, unfortunately, are not histories of peaceful cooperation in spiritual matters. Most religions have had stormy histories. Most of them have passed through persecution and have persecuted in turn. Most of these faiths have descended to us through a series of defense mechanisms which they set up in order to survive. They had to protect themselves from others by the most basic of all forms of protection, and that is difference. There had to be difference in order to preserve each separate nucleus of man's spiritual heritage. So historically, religion shows us the nobility of a few, the sincerity of many, and conflict of most. It has been a very complicated and interstrife-ridden situation. Coming into this present generation, those following in the ancient systems feel it necessary to take on these conflicts. They have to remember persecutions of the past. They have to remember the martyrdom of the saints. They have to remember the intolerance of the world against these various faiths as they were building up through time and history. And each in turn, like a disillusioned individual, has built its own defense mechanisms. It has created ways to protect itself against others. These protections are barriers. They are also isolators, and they contribute constantly to religious misunderstandings. We inherit this. It is part of our birthright. Just as we inherit the hereditary story of our race, our nation, and our ancestors. We are the product of that which has gone before. And coming into this world looking for help and guidance, we fall back upon some type of educational culture. We try to find out what has happened to make us what we are now. And when we explore this problem a little further, we realize that much that has happened in the past is contributing to the deformity of our immediate actions. We are over-influenced, we are prejudiced, we are bound into patterns which we cannot actually demonstrate to be correct, but which we are forced to accept because of religious allegiances. Now, most religions today are in a state of change. It is becoming ever more certain, for example, that the doctrine of hellfire and damnation has lost popularity. We are no longer very much interested in it. We remember what the English mystic William Law observed on one occasion. The soul in hell is nothing but the hell in the soul. And this is a very wise statement, for it tells us that almost all of these conflicts arise within ourselves, and that we become a battleground for previous beliefs upon which we must nourish our religious conviction, and which in many instances we find to be indigestible. So in this matter, the person is in a changing world. This change is not necessarily due to the sudden revelation of new spiritual values. It is the result of the inevitable realization that we must have more spiritual insight than the average person has today. We cannot live with what we have believed. Yet we have to be careful not to do what the agnostic does, cast overboard everything, because some parts of it are obviously fallible. We cannot turn from religion in toto without turning from our own soul. We must therefore attempt to readapt the various principles of faith to the emergencies of the hour, finding in our religion the strength to face the immediate problems of daily action and reaction. To do this, we must gradually come to the realization that religious allegiance is not a solution to our spiritual problem. We believe, for example, many people believe, that by becoming a nominal member of a congregation, the individual assures his own salvation. Little by little, it is coming home to us that this is not true. That it is not what a person belongs to. It is the way he conducts his own life that is the basis of his religion. The individual is not saved by being a member of something. He is saved by releasing the divine part of his own nature through his own conduct. He may do this in almost any level of belief. Under evangelical pressure, the individual may recover from alcoholism. He may get a new point of view on life. He may be impelled to search a little deeper or to build a little stronger type of faith. But the work he must do. The evangelist cannot make him good. The evangelist can only point out to him certain improvements which he can make in himself. And to make these is a decision, which is not a decision of membership, but a decision of conduct. Assuming that we have this type of situation, we see the churches in most parts of the world are beginning to recognize the right of the congregation to have its say in the teaching and the beliefs of that organization. In other words, churches are moving more and more onto a democratic footing. They are realizing, sometimes by choice, sometimes by necessity, that it is necessary for them to meet the challenge of contemporary events. This does not mean a compromise of religious principles. It simply means a wiser direction of the spiritual potential in the solving of problems. We still have the Sermon on the Mount. We still have the Pentateuch. We still have the Buddhist canons and all the different sacred books of the world, all of which teach us clearly that the true salvation of the individual lies in himself. It cannot be conferred. The only thing that can be conferred is encouragement. We can try to help people to see more clearly, but they must see for themselves. About the only thing that any religious organization can accomplish, really, is to serve as a seeing eye to help a blind person to be able to conduct his life in a reasonable way. Now, if we are going on with this situation, we also have to recognize, whether we like it or not, and whether it appears to be demonstrable or not, that humanity is one entity. Humanity is made up of beings, all of which are within a certain range of similarity. Some may be of different backgrounds and foregrounds. Some may be more educated, others less cultured. But humanity is a unit. And it is a unit because the principle of humanity abides in each human being. And that humanity principle is his own soul. It is within himself that his humanity abides. it is within himself finally that his guidance must come. Now, we may conceal this fact or overlook it or ignore it, but through circumstances, conditions that arise, problems that come up, there is a constant call upon internal resource. We really want to work from the best part of ourselves. We are seeking solution to our problem. Now, each person's problem is individual. There are many similarities, but no identities. Each individual has his own pattern of problem and purpose. This pattern can only be solved by the resources that he possesses. Now, if these resources are minimal, and he has very little contact with his own inner nature, then he is protected by the sheepfold. He is under the guidance and leadership of a shepherd. This shepherd has as his duty to protect the sheep. The sheep in this case can be parallel to the immature members of a family. Young people growing up have to have a shepherd. They have to have a guidance in those parts of life in which their own released internals are not strong enough to guide them. Furthermore, in very young or even adolescent peoples, the psychic or soul factor is not challenged sufficiently. Decisions are not clear because the individual's life is not yet purposed. He cannot be guided by his mistakes because, for the most part, he hasn't made them. And if he has, he doesn't know what they mean. So in the early part of all religious life, there is a common ground which even extends into the animal kingdom. And this common ground is a certain security as the result of the protection of adult members of a social group or a tribe or a clan or even a kind of animal. As we grow up, however, our ways of life gradually spread out. We may all have had very similar training. We may have all had very similar schooling up to a certain point. But out of the background, there gradually emerges an individual. This individual is said to reach maturity. And when he does this, he is subject to the responsibilities of mature living. He is expected to go out and create his own career. It is assumed that in time he will build his own family. Having attained maturity, or majority is perhaps a better word, because maturity is still elusive. The majority age, 18 now, used to be 21. The individual then emerges as a self-responsible being. Now, what does he bring with him to help him to be self-responsible? In many cases, he brings very little. He has not been well instructed in his family. He hasn't seen the example of close emotional relationships. He has not observed the family responsibilities equally distributed. He has only an education which is fitting him for some kind of a job. If he wants to go further, he must have more schooling. But in all this period of time, he is being worked on from the outside. He is being fitted into a groove or a pattern. And, of course, in our generation, this pattern is closing in with almost tragic intensity. So at 21, he suddenly stands on his own feet, but he does not know why. He does not know how to stand on his own feet. And he does not know what to do after he does get on his feet. All of these things are mysteries. And in these mysteries, there very often comes an attitude of helplessness. So the young person goes to anyone he can find whom he thinks belongs to his peer group and tries to get the information he needs. Sometimes he is invited to become a narcotics addict. Very often he receives from others only the same uncertainties that he himself possesses. Yet somehow he must gradually take his place in society. The blank look on his own face is the open door to his progress. Suddenly realizing that he does not know, and from his experiences and endeavors is not likely to find out, that he suddenly has to turn to himself for guidance. He hasn't too much to help him even in that, because in order to be helped from the inside, all of the hindrances on the outside have to be overcome. He has to unlearn in order to experience. He has to shift from the foundation of what he is taught to the foundation of what he needs in order to survive. This type of thinking really begins the religious life of the individual. He may not recognize it as religion. He may consider that it is intellectual or psychological. But actually, the moment he tries to solve his own problems, he releases from himself something that can never be conferred upon him from the outside. He falls into patterns of trial and error. These are natural. He must experiment. He must learn for himself. And the impulse to be an individual and learn for himself is a constructive one, unless his conditioning is so poor that everything that he does is going to continue to be dominated by external pressure. Assuming, however, that he is now beginning to think a little for himself, he may remember or realize that he belongs to some religion. And, much more important, some religion belongs to him. He has to find out how to explain or interpret these matters. If he's a member of a church, he may go to a church counselor to get help and advice in the selection of what he ought to do. From a church counselor, he will probably receive a more idealistic interpretation than he would if he takes an aptitude test. The counselor may try to advise him into what might be termed the sectarian virtues by which life must be regulated. Now, these basic virtues are not bad. They're pretty good. And if he follows them all, or most of them, with care, he is going to gradually reconstruct his own inner life. He's going to shift his center of consciousness from the outside to the inside of his own nature. He is going to begin to think and to plan, and also to develop certain moral and ethical foundations. These he can secure from almost any denomination of any faith in the world. They become the basis of a disciplined pattern. If he will accept this pattern, it will increase and unfold within his own nature. If he cannot accept it, because too much mental and emotional pressure is against it, then he will have to fall into the dilemmas of those who are not able to control their own lives. They get into one difficulty after another. Now, over this whole complete pattern of things lies the principle of divine wisdom. The deity is concerned with only one problem, the perfection of its creation. It has no intentions of failing, and failure is inconceivable to a being that possesses all power, all knowledge, all wisdom, all strength, and all love. To be perfect in these principles which we attribute to deity leaves very little space in our concept of God for doubts, jealousies, or for the belief that deity is partisan and therefore is subject to all kinds of earthly intemperances and intolerances. The fact that the complete plan of things is to move everything to the fulfillment of itself, and in so doing, to the release of the God in the self. If this is the plan, it doesn't require a great deal of theology, but it does for a time require a certain amount of diligence and faith. The individual has to believe that there is a meaning for his own life. He has to believe also that he is not living for himself alone, nor is he living for his world alone, or his neighbors, or his family responsibilities. He is living to fulfill deity. He is living that God may be made flesh and dwelt among us. Each person, therefore, is responsible for his share in the release of universal law, first through his own nature, and then through the natures of those around him to whatever degree he can. There can be success working with self. Working with others may or may not prove to be essentially beneficial. Always stimulate in others a desire to improve themselves. So with this religious concept, there comes an answer to the great problem of materialism. Materialism is simply the justification of a meaningless world. Materialism places all reward in terms of material things in a material lifetime. Life beyond the grave is disputed and denied by the true materialist. All rewards must be here. All success must be here. Because after here, to the materialist, there is nothing. Now it becomes immediately obvious that if this be true, then all efforts on the part of individuals to be anything are pure fantasy. But man, from the human beginning of himself, has had within him this hot core that refuses to accept materialism. It can be thrust upon his mind. It can be taught to him from the cradle to the grave. Its ambitions may dominate his life for years. But an actual materialist is only one in his mind, never in his heart or his soul. It is only the fact that the heart and soul have been blocked by attitudes which are not true. Having come to a point where we begin to realize these things, we can improve our state. Now, the infinite plan of things, working through cause and effect, presents us with a crisis like we are in at this moment. A crisis that is creating more religious thinking than anything that has happened to us in the last 1,000 years. Man reaches out toward God in emergency only. While things go along well, the individual is proud of himself and self-sufficient. But when his own life falls apart, then he realizes that he is inadequate. The world today is very close to falling apart. Nearly every excess, mistake, failure, and crime that we have committed in the name of progress is coming on back to us with terrific punishment factors. We are being warned every day that the policy we have lived by is not right. We have been assured that no matter how we bolster it up, how we try to put patches on it, we must either change the basic concept behind the structure or we cannot succeed. Now, this applies directly to the person. As long as we live by a structure that must fail, we will fail with it. The only way we can escape our own loss is by changing within ourselves and keeping faith with a structural concept that can survive and can fulfill the purpose for which it was intended. Private disaster is very much like international problem today. Disaster is complex, compound, interrelated. It captures the individual, and he knows not which way to turn to get out of it. Every remedy seems to make it worse. But the whole structure of remedy, the whole concept of modern living, is unsound. It has been perpetuated from generation to generation simply because individuals did not wish to go against their own personal ambitions. So now we have a time when religion is becoming increasingly important to us. And we have to take the faiths of our fathers and put them to work here and now. One thing that is true of most people is that they need a certain amount of associational support. The individual who finds himself completely alone in his beliefs or in his attitudes and discovers this too soon is in trouble. The individual who has no outside associations that support his convictions and has not developed sufficient internal resource to protect his convictions, this individual is truly on the horns of a dilemma. He cannot stay this way, however. He must either give up, as some do, or he must strengthen the source of solution in himself through a better understanding of life. In these various religions of the world, we have also other qualification levels, as Emerson pointed out, and Thoreau also, I think, wrote a little something on the subject, and that is that while we have names for religions, we do not have adequate identification of the sources and interminglings of religious teachings. It is a mistake to assume, for example, that any religion stands completely alone. There are no religions in the world which are not themselves mixtures. Every religion we have had a dependency on something that preceded it. Every religion has borrowed and begged, and in some cases stolen, the ideas of other faiths. Now, this is probably due to the fact that the believers in these different religions came from different backgrounds. And if these believers reached a point, a place of authority within a religion, they have begun to modify it by the wisdom that they brought to it in the first place. Little by little, all religions come in the end to contain within themselves the essential principles of all other religions.